This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Brian Matlock. He's running as a Republican Socialist candidate for Senate in the state of Kansas. Brian, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
To start things off, Brian, can you give us some brief background information and the reasons why you're running for office?
Yeah, basically, I grew up in Nampa, Idaho, in Republican family, and spent a lot of my life. My parents were real like religious people and were constantly like donating, volunteering their time, helping out their neighbors. And there are a lot of this kind of small town and rural communitarian ethic that I think has a lot more in common with socialism than with big business Republicans. And so I realized, like, as I went along my life, I initially was planning to be a minister and then got more in, like, social work type of stuff. And then as I began to question a lot of the basic services and want to understand the broader systemic issues that was causing, like, all the inequality and poverty and so I went back to school in economics at kind of a socialist economics program at UMKC, but felt like it was sort of this continuous trajectory of trying to take care of people and make the world a better place that I had gotten from my parents. And so been living in Kansas City, Kansas for 11 years, teaching and researching economics for the last several years, and kind of a friend asked me to run in this specific election. I mean, I'd been real interested in and involved in social issues and real focus on policy in my my program. I don't know if you know this, at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, we have kind of a policy emphasis, and one of my professors is Bernie Sanders' chief economist, so there's just like a lot going on with all of the federal policy research, and so that's kind of how I got into conversations about this, and somebody asked me to run. I didn't think any of the current options. It was kind of like status quo neoliberal Democrat versus far-right nationalist Chris Kobach and other just hardcore Trumpians. And so felt like both options are pretty bad. Like neoliberalism, I think, creates the conditions that breed the ethno-nationalism we've been seeing crop up around the world. And so it's not a good option other than the ethno-nationalism. So I was, I guess the whole idea is, can I create a coalition of like Bernie Sanders type of socialists with some of these like small town, rural, working class Republicans who at least at the local level, like really value taking care of each other. They value relationships and family over being acquisitive. And so, and then their emphasis on local control, I think, has a lot of overlap with some of the suggestions of like libertarian socialists, like worker cooperatives, participatory budgeting, federally funded but locally administered job guarantee, things like that. And so that's what I've been working on doing, trying to build that coalition.
To a lot of people, the term Republican socialist may sound like an oxymoron, But is there a tradition of that type of movement even within the Republican Party?
Absolutely. And I think there's a very legitimate place to say we're taking it back to its roots. I mean, the early radical abolitionist Republicans in the state of Kansas itself, there is a lot of overlap with socialists and, you know, lots of socialists talk about even Karl Marx and Abraham Lincoln had a correspondence going, and he read the paper that Marx was a regular correspondent in. And the group of radical Republicans, they called them, which were fighting here for abolition even before the end of, before it's sort of emancipation without proclamation. Like, we're just going to start freeing slaves, and there should be no compensation for slave owners. We believe that all people should be free, and human rights trump property rights, and we should focus on having an economy that works for people, not just whatever is going to grow the most. And so there is this, like, radical socialist bottom-up Midwestern movement all over Kansas 100 years ago. They were organizing farmers into cooperatives to protect against all the price fluctuations and exploitation from mining companies and other sorts of big industries at that point. And so there is this whole history. It's been, you know, between the Red Scares and Southern Strategy. It's interesting that a lot of Republicans in the state still really identify with that abolitionist history, but I think it's sort of empty. It could, like, saying, like, yeah, we agree with this history. Look at the stuff they actually said and did. Here's how that has a lot more in common with what I'm trying to do than what these other big business Republicans are trying to do, or white nationalists.
I mean, what people consider socialism, which is identified with the left, would you say that is one of the reasons that you decided to run as a Republican socialist is because issues of community or communitarianism are often neglected, or there's like a type of socialism that might put a strong emphasis on a centralized managerial state rather than communities?
Yeah, it's for a couple of reasons. I think it doesn't make any sense for, like, I was more or less radicalized to socialism directly from being a Republican, like, with very little intermediate time. And so I think there are so many problems with the Democratic Party and liberalism and how paternalistic it is, condescending, and there's so much of just this, like, team aspect. It's really hard to have Republicans want to vote for a Democrat when so many of the Democratic politicians are completely out of touch with them. Even here in Kansas, somebody from the Republican or the Democratic Party was like, we only need to win 10 out of 105 counties to win this election. So why would we waste our resources in all these places? So they have decades where they're not organizing, spending time with, reaching out to rural and agricultural communities. And then in this election, not only are they doing the lesser of evils-ism, but they're spending millions of dollars amplifying Kris Kobach, the far most extremist white nationalist in the race, in order, because they think he's most beatable. First of all, that didn't work with Trump, and they're actively making the long-term prospects for politics in this nation worse in order to do their thing. And so what I think is they're build off of the shared things, like, as socialists, I think our commitment should be to the working class, not some bourgeois party that has all sorts of problems, regardless of which one it is. And saying, like, the good things that do happen in the Democratic Party are because there's been lefties organizing and pushing them for a long time. And so I think work within both parties, outside of either party, and in red states, there's no need to, like, drag someone through corporate centrist Democrats to socialism. Just take them straight there. And yeah, I think there is a good place for emphasizing the type of, like, bottom up. How can we use federal resources to support what local decision making and empower what's happening on the ground rather than centralize everything?
So you support a locally based federal job guarantee. Are you also a supporter of the universal basic income that Andrew Yang was proposing, or do you think there are kind of concerns that, like, with trends like automation, that the masses could just be given, like, a subsistence standard of living on a UBI while most of the jobs are gone?
I am okay with the UBI having sort of a limited, like, I think there are a lot of people who support UBI whose heart is in the right place, and I want to keep the conversation going. I know both the job guarantee folks and UBI are trying to fix the problems with it. My worry with the UBI is that a lot of very conservative economists advocate for it, and their vision is cut all social spending, just give some subsistence check, and then the markets will decide. What I worry about is there's not a price anchor, and so it's sort of like offering access to healthcare, which means a lot of people don't actually have it. We need to make sure everyone has healthcare. And similarly, they're going to use it as sort of a Trojan horse to get rid of social spending, but then not actually make sure that the UBI is consistent with social spending. And then it sort of creates the real world conditions that wealthy people already have the illusion currently exists, which is everyone is suckling off of my teat and I'm just providing for everybody. That's actually the inversion of what's really happening, which is everyone's working hard to produce this great wealth and then wealthy people are hoarding all of it. But it does create this weird situation where now we actually have people who are just receiving the subsistence checks. And if the amount of jobs keep, like right now, what'll happen is, I don't know, people will, it's like what middle class and upper class people have already. It's like it'll help you go back to grad school or take an internship or stuff like that. But long term, let's say technological employment does really make it so there are just not enough jobs to go around. It worries me that you would have a position where some people are dependent on what that is. But the people who have jobs are going to have this, it's going to be politically very difficult to get them to make the UBI an actual livable wage. Right now, if we just do it, it'll be like a little running around money, which I'm fine with. The reason I kind of emphasize, and then I don't think there's a good price anchor. It's like, okay, so we dump money into the economy, and it's easy for that to just get absorbed into real estate prices and other sorts of things. And over time, it gets less and less helpful, but it's hard to keep it consistent with inflation without running the risk of spiral and whatnot. Anyways, with a job guarantee, I think we have the ability to, like, we always will need productive work, work that is involved in the community. Over time, we can use it to set it's sort of whatever is paid will be the de facto minimum wage. And so you can use it to give a livable wage as technological unemployment takes place. We can move down the work week and it's sort of easy to do this in a direct job and then have it sort of put indirect pressure on the private sector to bring down the work week. You can support community things like arts and infrastructure, education, all sorts of different things that aren't, I think in the long run, won't be traditional work, but will be still you're contributing useful things to society.
So it's a locally based job guarantee. So would this be a federal program, or can you explain more about the details about how the local functions would work in implementing that, and what types of, specifically, like, what types of jobs are do you have in mind?
Yeah, so it'll operate on several levels. One is the federal level, as much as we're going to be transitioning our energy grid to renewable energy and lots of other big picture projects like that, we will have some of the jobs will be on the federal level. But I don't know if you're familiar with participatory budgeting, but what happens is if there's a discretionary budget, often at the city level, so there's extra money left over, rather than, say, the city council deciding what happens to that, it's kicked back to community groups, which organize democratic processes for people at, like, a community district to decide, how do we want to spend this money? And this has already been implemented in thousands of cities internationally and is often very popular kind of across political lines because it gives people more say, like, what are your priorities? And people kind of, okay, there are several meetings, and then they'll do research how much each of the things we want cost, like, could be infrastructure, could be cleaning up areas, could be, I don't know, all sorts of different things. And then they come back and people vote on it. And so I think there could be very similar processes used for the job guarantee. And we already have this unemployment infrastructure in our country. So there are unemployment offices all around the U.S. And instead, those can be employment offices. And so we have a space for community members to decide. There's plenty of work to go around whenever there's a downturn in the economy, even if we have 20% unemployment rate. There's lots of jobs that need done. We need infrastructure. We're going, as the baby boomers are getting older, we're going to need more people taking care of them. And so looking at what our needs are on the local level, setting priorities, and then having people set determine what those jobs will be so that as there's unemployment, those people will be put into socially useful jobs. And again, could be things like just doing the arts or other sorts of work that's not in the traditional sense based on the needs of the community. And that will make sure that in times of downturn, people still have employment, there's still spending happening in the economy, but if the economy is heating up, they get bid back out into the private sector.
With, like, the pandemic and the economic crisis, is leading to, a greater corporate consolidation as small businesses are bankrupt, but what type of state policies would you propose that would help people become entrepreneurs and start up and run their own small businesses?
Yeah, first of all, we are at all levels basically actively supporting the corporate takeover, both because corporations are writing all of our laws and regulations that give them disproportionate power, as well as, like, the bailout and things. They filtered the CARES Act funding through banks, which their job is to determine who's credit worthy. And in capitalism, that's a massive problem because a rich douchebag who wants to loan $5, you know they're good for it. But a poor person with kids who has no job who wants to borrow $5, they probably won't be able to pay it back. And so you always tend to loan money towards those who already have the most of it. And so what we've seen with this CARES Act funding that the banks have kind of been screening people is it overwhelmingly has gone to, like, mid-sized businesses, franchises, things like that, and not the small businesses which it was supposedly supposed to go to. So I think we need the funding should be, like, we need to take away the discretionary the banks kind of deciding who gets it, and then use effective tax policy on the back end to actually deal with the distributional issues. But we should be supporting as many as possible being thriving at the end. Because, like you said, every crisis, big corporations just gobble up more and more of the economy. Long term, I would also like to see a lot more funding and emphasis on local cooperatives and cooperative finance rather than centralized banking. That's generally a lot healthier for local communities and has money circulating in them, more local control of that.
If hypothetically you were in the Senate right now, what type of COVID stimulus would you propose, taking into different factors, including unemployment, the idea of like an emergency UBI, and then the whole handle like the corporate and the corporate level stimulus? What kind of package would you personally propose?
Yeah, so you have to address the crisis at the three main levels it's happening at. One, at the individual level, we're facing massive number of people going off of healthcare because they can't afford the rising premiums and they're not getting income, they're facing evictions, and then the consumer spending is low. So if we need people to stay home, we got to pay them to stay home. Yes, emergency UBI for sure. We should be implementing a federal jobs guarantee, I think, which would help us with some of the large-scale testing and contact tracing that we need with mitigating the crisis, as well as providing some of the personal protective equipment and other things in our schools, and then being able to afford putting people in important, needed jobs like fixing our broken, awful infrastructure. So pay people to stay home, fix healthcare, or provide universal healthcare. As long as we need people to stay at home, emergency UBI. Businesses, we need a stimulus. I think there is no good reason to let businesses fail in the current time. Like, make sure that they can meet their financial commitments. And then the other is state and local governments. We have to stabilize the balance sheets of state and local governments, because what we're already looking at is just an immense shortfall. And it makes no sense to have us fire a bunch more people because there is a budget crisis to cut funding to universities and schooling and infrastructure that's already in such a bad shape. So the federal government should make sure at the state and local levels we have the money needed to continue to function services, so we don't just get into the spiral where, oh, the economy's bad, let's cut more jobs. Oh, now it's worse, and so on and so on. We can, yeah. Very robust stimulus, but in the long run, we should be setting up more automatic stabilizer programs like the job guarantee that kind of kick in without anyone having to pass anything additionally when there's an economic crisis, but then recede when the economy's getting better.
And as far as funding these programs, what type of tax policies would you like to see implemented?
So I am a modern money theory economist. I'm not sure if you're very familiar with it, but essentially I don't think you have to pay for it dollar for dollar. Like, essentially, one person's spending is another person's income, right? So a set amount of dollars in the economy will pass hands a number of different times. It's going around, so one set of dollars will provide a number of different incomes. If people are spending at a lower rate, that is essentially like there's less money in the economy. Now, our economy, the dollars that circulate in our economy, are the deficit. Like, a federal deficit is a private sector surplus. When they spend into the economy, that is the money that circulates in the economy. So the federal government having a deficit is not in and of itself a bad thing, especially since I support a permanent 0% interest rate policy, because I don't think people should be making a bunch of money off of money, and we set the interest rate. So I think as long as there's excess capacity, like once the rate of spending goes way down, and we have empty factories, unemployed workers, we can put those real resources together. We can make sure that the money is there as we need it. You just don't want to, if we're at full capacity and full employment, if you start pumping a bunch of money into the economy, then it's not going to float any more resources. It'll just cause inflation. So as long as we have this immense excess capacity I think we can spend without running a risk of inflation. I do support a more progressive tax policy, but that's largely because I think it is a threat to democracy, to so few people have so much wealth. And it's bad for the economy in various ways to have such an inequality and have so few people have so much decision making over the economy. And so, yeah.
Are you familiar with the idea of a public infrastructure bank rather than states having to borrow money from at high interest from private banks?
I have not heard much about that, but sounds like a good policy.
Yeah, I'm not an economic expert, so I can't really explain it in depth, but I guess, yeah, I mean, Ellen Brown is she's the person most notable for that, as she ran for, like, California treasurer under the Green Party and has written numerous books, but this idea of funding state governments through public banking.
Yeah, I would definitely, in general, support public banking option, because often the big banks do not do what is in best interest of society, and there are so many guarantees to prop up our payment system that they really aren't taking much risk. I don't know. The deposit, federal deposit insurance it sounds like it's consumer protection, but really it's investment insurance. It's making sure banks don't lose their money even when they're taking risks. So why are they getting enormous profits and so on and so forth? Yeah.
As far as these massive corporate monopolies, especially with big tech, like Google, Amazon are the obvious examples, what types of policies would you support? There's already been discussion about antitrust regulations. I guess the most radical proposal would be basically turning a lot of these like Google or Amazon into public utilities. That's like the most radical proposal, but under the current Senate and Congress, I'm pretty skeptical of anything getting done with that.
Yeah, it is. I think that is a long way off, but it is something we need to talk about. What happens to all these, they're super debt finance up front, they have a higher use value, but then as they go along, they find more and more ways to beat money out of you. And then with the disinformation campaigns and all sorts of problems, and it's so centralized, I think we should definitely be considering other options. I have a lot to learn about all of that to see, like, I have a less clear idea of exactly how to design that and what the general policy would be, but I definitely could see using, like, internet, fiber cables, other sorts of things as a public utility, another social media, but that's something I need to have a lot more conversations and learn more about before I'm going to come down about exactly what it needs to look like.
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues you mentioned at the beginning of the show was about how support for Trump initially, I mean, obviously you're not a fan of Trump, but it was sort of a reaction to neoliberalism. And yeah, I mean, as far as Trump's actual accomplishments about bringing jobs back, there's a lot of skepticism, but he ran on the issue of largely in opposition to free trade and deindustrialization. And yeah, I mean, Kansas is probably impacted, maybe not to the same degree as, like, places as the Rust Belt, but I'm sure Kansas is impacted by this. But what are your thoughts on the issues of free trade and outsourcing? And are you sympathetic to protectionism, or do you see potential problems with those policies?
I see big problems, and Kansas has suffered quite a bit because farmers have had trouble selling any of their crops, and so farmers and ranchers have really struggled during this time period. I think just long term, the way the debate is set up is not great. It's like during the last major free trade time period about 100 years ago, which ended quite poorly in two world wars and a Great Depression, but a very similar dynamics where you have raw material producers and like selling crops or beef or something, they're competing on a global scale with everyone in the world who's growing the same things. But then the corporations doing the finance, the supply lines, the technology, the intellectual property rights, they have so much protection from competition. So they end up extracting almost all of the wealth being created by the globalization system. So we've seen farmers just locked further and further in debt. They're losing their farms, and then they get gobbled up. And so there's this huge corporate takeover of agriculture. The protectionism, I think, when we have the global commodity market, so we're producing for these global markets rather than producing for our own need, it puts us in a vulnerable place. It's a national security issue because it's hard for our farmers to actually compete with how cheap people will produce internationally because of the desperate conditions. But it would be in our really poor interest for us to just get rid of all food production in the U.S. Okay, well, we can get it cheaper from abroad, so let's just do away with all farming in the United States. That puts us in such a vulnerable position, even with COVID, with not having as much trade and travel going on. But if we were in a war situation or something where we had trouble importing food, that would be absolutely disastrous if we didn't produce any of it in general. Now, I think we should pursue, I wouldn't call it, I make kind of a distinction between corporate globalism and international solidarity. So I think I don't support Trump's like mercantilist policies where he's, you have this austerity that's going on, and so you're trying to run a trade surplus and get more money coming in than going out, but the trade balance is 1-to-1, so we can't all run a trade surplus. Somebody's going to be running a deficit, and so trying to just scratch and claw every bit out, what we're not, like, everybody ends up losing in that situation. But I think for the health of the environment and for the health of our local economies and farming, we should be moving away from massive corporate farming to more regenerative farming, local production and biodiversity, and smaller family and cooperative farms, and that we'll be producing more things that are produced and consumed locally. And so I think long-term, those are some of the directions we're going to go. But just in general, I think it's very short-sighted what's going on with China. China's not going anywhere, and trying to, quote, get a good deal and throw our weight around while we still have it is bad news in the long term, as China relies on us less and gets more and more in a position to be throwing their own weight around. We should be establishing a fair trading relationship and not trying to suck every last bit out of our trading relationship that we can.
There has been this corporate consolidation of farming. I mean, there's a lot of different impacts of that, impacts on the environment, and I mean, high levels of pollution, and probably a contribution to poverty as well. What types of legislation would you like to see that would have an impact on the agricultural system?
I'm still learning a lot about that. I mean, some of the suggestions I've heard is outlaw industrial feedlots. Like, they are, it goes from manure being healthy for the environment to being absolutely toxic. And if, like, the type of consolidation we've seen in all of these industries, I think we have to stop actively supporting these and really start challenging the cult of efficiency that is going on, because what we've seen is all of the policies have been really supporting large industrial farming over small-scale farming, like the subsidies and other sorts of things. But we've moved heaven and earth. We've had massive depopulation in rural areas because fewer and fewer families are needed, which has been really hard on rural communities in a variety of ways, been harder to support grocery stores and support healthcare, like clinics and hospitals. And so a lot of farmers wish we could turn back time 40 years to when there was closer knit, smaller farming, closer knit communities. So I think having some type of new Homestead Act that's less racist and genocidal, but that is sort of like, if we start breaking up corporate agriculture, how do we like bring people back to farming and start creating local and cooperative farming? And I don't know, there's a lot of work to be done in that. And honestly, I think there are a few people, but a lot of socialists and progressives are really focused on urban policy. And so I think there needs to be quite a bit more emphasis paid to rural and agricultural issues.
I mean, there have been this phenomenon of deaths of despair, alcoholism, opiate overdoses, and suicides. Why do you think that trend has disproportionately impacted rural areas, and how would you address that problem?
Yeah, so our society is pretty sick in a lot of ways, like looking at social pathologies that we have. In some countries, you can buy opioids over the counter with no prescription, and they aren't having a crisis like we're having where you have to get a prescription, and it's still so impacting our society that our life expectancy is decreasing. We've had guns around for a long time, but now people are accumulating them with the idea they might need to use them on their neighbors. We're having all these mass shootings and things. There are a lot of things that are happening that show we are sick as a society, and we have to address that. And I think it is directly, I mean, this makes me such a traditional socialist in the sense I have a strongly materialist bent. I think the fact that we've seen the average work week increase by about 10 hours a week over the last 40, 50 years, while women have also entered the workforce, so we have less social time, less we're doing more of the, there's not the gender division of labor with household labor, and so that's being done in our free time. We are having like all of this competition and inequality, and so we're producing more wealth than ever before in history, but people are working longer, they're having more trouble paying rent, more trouble paying for health care. And it's just like, it's sort of like why nationalism and fascism is so prevalent in these times of global free trade, where you have like all this wealth being created, but for like the bottom earners and even a lot of middle class, we're just seeing a declining standard of living. Like, why do we have lowering life expectancy, increasing mortality rates of mothers and all these things? And so I think that makes it ripe for blaming people and for these sorts of, we have all these culture wars and division that are sort of distractions from, I think, a lot of the real issues. And I'm not saying like the lived experience of racism or anti-immigrant behavior is something in and of itself. I'm not wanting to discount that as like its own unique thing that needs specific attention, not just like, oh, if we fix the economy, then we won't have racism. Like I'm not that extreme of a materialist, but we still, I tend to think that just seeing 40 years of increasing healthcare, housing, and education while wages are stagnant, like that cannot go on forever. You don't, like, just mathematically, it's impossible for it to go on forever. And so what's going to give, and that type of pressure people feel with student debt growing bigger and bigger and harder. Meanwhile, a lot of careers are having lower return on investment, more competitive to get a job with an education. It's just stressful to live. You're seeing like mental health getting worse, suicide getting worse. And so I think some of the things like passing healthcare for all, like completely, like really seriously investing in mental health, having free education, canceling student debt, like completely reforming our criminal justice system so that the things we already have a better ways that are more effective of dealing with and more cost effective at dealing with homelessness, children and youth, antisocial behavior, drug addiction, all sorts of things that we already have better solutions for, but we just deal with our social issues by locking people up. It's absurd. It's expensive. It makes our society less safe. So by dealing with a lot of those underlying issues, I think we will be in a better position, but I think we also have to find a way around the partisan trench war. Like, you just see on both sides, Trump is the only problem in our country and not willing to seriously address anything else. And they don't see that this trend is going on around the world. But then on the Republican, it's just like they asked at a recent forum, what's the most important issue facing our nation? And Kris Kobach mentions transgender athletes. Oh my God, like who of any persuasion would put that in the top 1,000 issues facing our nation? But it's just this petty culture war that they're obsessed with and using to avoid a lot of the root issues we're facing as a society.
But it does seem that right now that it's like a sort of left versus right culture war. And the more, yeah, the material-based issues are kind of being ignored or neglected.
So that's, in a way, part of what I'm trying to accomplish with the Republican Socialist thing is to build a language and a framework that helps working-class Republicans see, like, hey, these values you already have a lot in common with socialism, and we can build together. And, like, rather than with Black Lives Matter getting into this stupid, like, well, I'm not racist, I have a black friend, and this one black person who is against Black Lives Matter was on Fox and talked about, like, it's just saying, hey, look, what the black community feels like our society doesn't care about them. If you do care about them, like you said you do, how can you show that? How can you show up for them and help them, help heal those hurts, help them? And so trying to change the discussion to stop being, it's so defensive, and it's just like, no, I'm not racist, but then they don't do anything to actually show up for people. They always talk about, like, oh, we're the party of Lincoln, we're the party that abolished slavery, and the first Republican senator that was black was like 1880s, and the first Democratic senator that was black was like 1980s, and they have all of these things. So how can we sort of, like, do a jujitsu and, like, operationalize? Okay, yeah, if we're the abolitionist party, then how do we live out that value in the world rather than just use it as a dismissal of any accusations of racism?
So you mentioned you have two main opponents in the race. So Kris Kobach is the main Republican, and then there's a Democrat who, he's kind of more of a neoliberal. Have you gotten any chances to debate the other candidates?
Yeah, and luckily this last like week and a half, I've had events almost every single night, forums and different events all over. They've mostly been like, they'll ask us all about different questions, but it's not a debate where you're supposed to call each other out. But I kept kind of pushing some of the economic issues and I think making them look bad because, honestly, I just know a lot more about it, and they don't have very good economic policies. And so Kris Kobach actually tried to attack me and call me out. And I knew considerably more about the issue, and so I'm like, nope, here's the receipts, here's where you're wrong, everyone can Google this graph, it'll show you right there, this is what happened. And so it has given me an opportunity to make my case, and I've gotten feedback from a lot of people who've seen me, and like both written surveys side by side and listened to the live debates and forums, who are like, hey, you're making a lot of sense. And even tailoring my message over time and finding what connects with Republicans. And so some of the just Republican, county level Republican groups that I spoke to, some of them came up and, yeah, I'm sure we don't agree on everything, but like that economic stuff you were saying made a lot of sense. So trying to talk about like a lot of Republican, average working class Republicans distrust big corporations just as much as big government. And so kind of using the already existing contradictions, heighten those contradictions to break up some of the existing coalitions and alliances that there are, and forming a new one is kind of the tactic.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you have the same issue on the Democratic Party, where the donor class is out of touch with their base, but I've actually seen numerous polls that show that rank-and-file Republican voters are to the left, or you could say more socialist on economics, than the elected officials and the donor class.
Yeah, and I think it has been hard like that for decades. Like, socialism used to be very like outworking, organizing farmers and miners and other sort of things, but right now it's overwhelmingly urban, highly educated, and so who has been organizing in these red states, agricultural states, rural areas, has been people like white nationalists or Rush Limbaugh, all of the Savage Nation, all of these like extreme far right radio show hosts and things. And so you see a really sharp contrast between just average working class Republicans who aren't hooked on that stuff are actually like pretty dang decent people, and you can have really productive, positive conversations with them. But once they've been radicalized by those people, it's just hard to get in a word edgewise. They're just like Barbara Beaulieu, who's centrist Democrat, corporate Democrat. She's a socialist, communist, fascist, which is all the same, cultural Marxist, and she's gonna destroy America with her totalitarianism. It's just like, what are you even talking? They can't define any of their terms. They just regurgitate these So we should be doing the work to organize in those areas to provide a different narrative of the really crappy, unjust things that have been happening in rural America, provide a better narrative, organize them around their issues in solidarity with women, people of color, LGBTQ, and immigrants, rather than scapegoating them. And that's what I'm passionate about doing, is trying to start organizing and providing a different path forward for those people.
And the election date of the GOP primary, it's August 4th. What are your plans until that the first round of the election?
Oh, yeah, basically a week from tomorrow. So just keeping busy on doing the interviews and speaking engagements and social media and various things. I sort of, I'll be honest, my hopes were at the beginning, I'm running against 10 other people. They're all running on a platform of, I'm the most Trumpian Republican. So I was hoping they're going to split the vote enough, and there's going to be enough people who don't like that, and some of the, I call them good neighbor Republicans, who kind of, so my hope was I could find this niche, the others would split the vote enough that I could squeak out a win in the Republican primary, and then in a red state, and then steamroll the centrist Dem and kind of like really shake things up and challenge both parties. It was quite a curveball. It sort of took a while to build the momentum to get any sort of name recognition. So especially with COVID, where I couldn't be meeting people face to face, and like kind of bottomed out the fundraising, and so had to let go my campaign manager, and have mostly been doing the campaign by myself with a few volunteers over time. So I hope that I'm like the best of, or get the most votes of the Republicans who didn't have like a huge budget. But realistically speaking, I think I have done a good job the last few weeks, especially with all the interviews and forums and things that have been going on to raise different issues and start building a movement, but not seeing a lot of likelihood of winning this particular election.
And as far as Republican socialism goes, are you the only candidate running on that platform, or are there other candidates, and is it like a broader ongoing movement?
There have been a couple others who've run as progressive Republicans. Rob Ryers, I think is his last name. He ran as a progressive Republican in Arkansas a couple years back, and now is the head of Brand New Congress. And then John Ivey in California ran as a progressive Republican, both like fairly similar to what I'm doing, I would say. And it's hard to say. I think it's hard to say how all of this like partisan realignment is going to shake out, because a lot of the lefties are dissatisfied with the mainstream Dems. There's a lot of change going on. Trump is honestly not a traditional conservative in many ways, and so all the weird like libertarian versus nationalist versus evangelical versus like old compassionate conservative Bush type, like just very real conflicts. And so I guess we'll see where it goes. I'm also kind of watching like the People's Party is trying to get started up, like the old populist. So we will see. I would definitely hope that we can really be reaching out to and organizing all of the working class and helping people realize that they do have things in common and with immigrants and people of color and things. And but it's going to be a challenge. So we got our work cut out for us. This election cycle's been disappointing. At the beginning, I was like, maybe we'll have a Bernie presidency and there'll be this like massive progressive wave. I think the progressives have done well considering how little money and name recognition they've had, but really we've just not won all that many primaries and elections so far, which is alarming given the urgency of some of our problems like healthcare, environment, other things. So who knows?
Brian, we're close to the end of the show. Do you want to plug your campaign website?
Sure, you can find me at www.matlockforsenate.com, as well as follow me on social media. I'm at Kansas Brian on both YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Matlock for Senate on Facebook. So give me a follow and join the conversation.
Brian Matlock, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on, and be interesting to follow this race.
Yeah, I really appreciate y'all having me. Thanks.